This is the Citizen of Heaven podcast number 243, Mail. I'm Hal Hammonds, Citizen of Heaven, your embedded correspondent in Satan's world. Thanks for listening, rating, and subscribing. It's Reading Month here on the podcast, and I'm taking you down to the mailbox with me this week to see what lessons we might find there. We'll discuss the snail mail that served the apostles so well in the first century and that still serves us today, if we read it correctly. A murder scheme that has absolutely nothing to do with the postman and how many times he rings the bell. The blessings and burdens of the envelopes I usually never open at all. And the price I'm willing to pay to preach the gospel of board games. We'll start with what I've been preaching. More than half of the New Testament is given to us in letter form. A lot more. In fact, if you consider Luke, Acts, and Revelation to be letters, and they are, when you think about it, that leaves only Matthew, Mark, and John, written in a different format. Wow, I never thought about it that way, Hal, you may be saying. So what? The point is, letters have writers and audiences. To understand the message, you need to know as much as possible about the parties in question. Yes, this is yet another way of preachers trying to tell you about context. You've probably heard more about context than you care to think about, but context is absolutely critical if you want to derive the proper meaning from the text. Now, maybe that's not what you're looking for. Maybe you'd rather just get the lesson you like, or the lesson that gets you what you want in the short term. Lots of people read the Bible that way. But if God wanted to convince you that you're fine the way you are, that you should do what you've already decided to do, he wouldn't have bothered giving you the gospel in the first place. But he did give you the gospel. Or perhaps more accurately, he gave it to his messengers 2,000 years ago, and he preserved it for you and me through his providence. We really are reading other people's mail when we read Romans or 1 Peter or Revelation. And it's perfectly clear that it meant something special for the initial audience. It means something for us too. But it stands to reason that a message given in a different time and place doesn't always fit neatly into our modern framework. To some, that means accepting the parts of the text that fit in well with our modern culture and rejecting the rest. But that can't be God's plan. The gospel is by its nature countercultural. God has always required people to conform to his will, not vice versa. So does that mean we all need to live as first century Jews, travel on foot, speak Greek? It's a complicated issue, one I can't properly address in 5 minutes. But I would like to share with you one simple measuring stick that helps me in some sticky situations, and this is it. Distinguish between biblical requirements that have their roots in the will of God versus biblical requirements that have their roots in human culture. I'll say that again. Roots in the will of God versus roots in human culture. I'll give you an example. Paul writes in Romans 1, 26 and 27, quote, "For this reason, God delivered them over to disgraceful passions. Their women exchanged natural sexual relations for unnatural ones. The men in the same way also left natural relations with women and were inflamed in their lust for one another. Men committed shameless acts with men and received in their own persons the appropriate penalty for their error." End quote. Homosexuality is sinful, and this is not the only New Testament passage that says so. I've covered loving all your neighbors, treating sinners with dignity and humanity in related subjects in other contexts. I don't want to go over that now. The point is, the Bible condemns homosexual activity. Now, one of the responses to this is that homosexuality was part of the pagan, idolatrous culture of the day. Being a homosexual, we're told, was tantamount to being a worshiper of idols, and that idolatry is the real sin, not homosexuality. And since our culture does not put homosexuality in that light, the rule does not apply to us. I agree with all that except for the last part. Yes, it was a cultural matter. But it was not a cultural matter at its core. Male-female relations is at the very center of what it means to be a human being. God specifically created us male and female, Genesis 1:27. We are different by design. And one of the most obvious reasons for that is the sexual relationship. We were told in Genesis 1:28 to be fruitful and multiply. We are one flesh, Genesis 2:24, as men and women in a way that is antithetical to homosexuality. This is not a cultural norm. This is God's eternal will for all of mankind. On the other hand, the lifting up of holy hands in 1 Timothy 2:8 is cultural. Prayer is a universal principle seen throughout the Bible. At no point in the Scriptures, Old or New Testament, is a priority placed on posture. We have standing prayers, kneeling prayers, prostrate prayers. We have silent prayers, shouted prayers, unison prayers, prayers with leaders. Always the emphasis is on the attitude of the heart, not the positioning of particular body parts. Clearly, in Timothy's world, Christians, likely moved by the Holy Spirit directly, prayed with lifted hands. And far be it from me to tell someone to keep their hands in their pockets if they want to apply this literally. But the culture at Lakewoods Drive is not a hand-lifting culture, for better or for worse. I don't feel the least bit disconnected from God or rebellious against God by simply bowing my head in prayer and holding Tracy's hand. I could go on, but my 5 minutes is up. Bottom line, find a way to adhere to God's requirements, all of them, in the culture where you find yourself. And don't condemn your brothers in a different country or a different time for not looking exactly like you do when you do it.
This is what I've been reading.
I picked up a one-volume set of James M. Cain novels this year. I'd never read a book by James M. Cain, but I recognized all three of the titles. And yes, it was deeply discounted. Hal Hammond's famous tightwad, writing coach on my trip through the literary world. I enjoyed Mildred Pierce and Double Indemnity very much, and I hope to come back to one or both of them at a later date. But today I want to focus on Cain's first novel, the one that established him as an author to be reckoned with, The Postman Always Rings Twice. Actually, that's not quite right. The book is great, but I'm not actually here to talk about the book. I'm here to talk about the title, the postman in the title particularly, the postman who does not make a single appearance in the book other than on the title page and the page headers. As I mentioned, Postman was Cain's first novel, or rather his first published novel. He'd been trying to break into the book business for years, getting one rejection letter after another from publishers who found his work not quite worth the paper they were being asked to print them on. It got to the point where hearing the mail arrive was bad news. Every appearance of the postman was yet another potential rejection. He didn't really want to pick up the mail at all. At the time, Cain was friends with a screenwriter named Victor Lawrence. He discussed the concept of postman angst with Lawrence, who completely related. It was Lawrence who pointed out that back in the day, letter carriers would ring the doorbell twice when they were carrying telegrams. Ostensibly, that was because telegrams often required a response, so you would want the postman to stick around while you opened it. In truth, it was probably just the postman wanting a tip. In any case, telegrams were relatively expensive and relatively urgent, and as a result, they tended to be bad news. The idea of the double ring eventually became symbolic of inevitability. And that leads to the book, in which the criminal plan of the two main characters seems to work in the beginning, but eventually ends with double disaster. As someone who used to really hate opening up the credit card statement, I can relate. Leave the envelope closed the first time if you want, but the bad news will come back next month again, with interest and threats attached. I dislike using pagan concepts like fate or karma to describe this phenomenon. I prefer the biblical concept of accountability. There is a reckoning at the end of the day. God will balance his books. And apart from grace, you will be found wanting. This inspires some inappropriate reactions in the hearts of many. Some will despair and quit. Don't even bother opening the mail. Just continue with business as usual until the car runs off the cliff. Some will trust that a merciful God who claims to love them will just make the bad news magically go away. And again, continue with business as usual until the car runs off the cliff. A proper approach to Jesus standing at the door and ringing the bell, to adapt an image from Revelation 3:20 bit, is to embrace the bad news and Jesus' remedy. Let him in as quickly as possible. Acknowledge your missteps and your inability to deal with them. But don't sin the more that grace may increase, as Paul warns in Romans 6:1. Instead, as Jesus told the woman caught in adultery in John 8:11, go, and from now on do not sin anymore. In the end, the gospel Jesus brings is good news, not bad news. The good news is you have redemption through the blood of Jesus. Without that, though, all you have is your own sin. And that's the worst news there could possibly be. this is what I've been hearing. I heard someone say once, you know you've become an adult when you start thinking of mail as a bad thing. I absolutely agree. Now, maybe the modern generation can't relate to this at all, so let me insult your intelligence for a minute. Once upon a time, important correspondence occurred almost exclusively through the U.S. Postal Service. Bills, subscription notices, the TV guide, most or all of that sort of thing is taken care of online today. But back in the day, you either got it in the mailbox or you didn't get it at all. And since you pretty much had to pick up your mail every day at the risk of missing something important, retailers quickly figured out they could use the U.S. mail as a way of getting your business. And the post office, apparently in an effort to be friendly to businesses, chose to give them a break on postage for items that went out to pretty much everyone. Hence, junk mail. When you're a kid, mail's exciting. Maybe it's an early birthday card or a letter from a pen pal. Even your first credit card application is good news. Makes you feel like a grown-up, even if you don't fill it out. You get an invitation to join the Columbia Record Club, if that's even a thing still. And you carefully consider whether to get 9 albums for just 1 cent, plus postage, with the understanding that you'll be required to buy 6 more at the regular price in the next year. After a few years in the adult world, you get a bit jaded. Just the other day, I asked Tracy for about the 10th time in the last 30 years whether she wanted a free steak dinner and the possibility of a free vacation as well. All we would have to do is sit through a presentation of some sort for an hour or so. For about the 9th time, she said no and refused to back off. One time she said no and did back off, an unfortunate 4-hour time suck with a timeshare representative that I will not ever be allowed to forget. Anyway, unless you're listening to this episode on a Sunday or a national holiday, most likely you can go to your mailbox and find something that claims to be working in your best interest. Coupons for a new pizza place in your neighborhood. 10 reasons why you'll be better off if the new bond issue passes. Yet another invitation to join AARP. That last one may just be for people in my age bracket. They all make it sound like you're their best friend in the world. Not your neighbor who pulls the exact same offer out of his mailbox while you're looking at yours. You. You are the special one. You are the one they love. You and you alone. It sounds a lot like the siren call of the adulterous woman in Proverbs. Over and over again through the first 9 chapters, this woman makes her sales pitch to the naive young man. You're the one she wants. She flatters you. She bats her eyes at you. She makes you think you're the only person in the world. When in truth, you're far from the first and far from the last. She will suck the life out of you with no regard for you at all, and then move on to the next sucker. Agur, the son of Jaca, describes her in Proverbs 30, verse 20. This is the way of the adulteress. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I have done nothing wrong. I'm painting a pretty cynical picture for the advertising industry in general here, and I don't want to do that. If you're in advertising, I'm sure you're doing noble and important work. I mean, no disrespect to you personally or even to advertising in general. But I will say, for the benefit of listeners who may be young enough to enjoy junk mail, you need to develop a certain level of healthy skepticism. I'm not saying the local merchant isn't a good guy offering a good product for a good price. I'm saying what you've heard countless others say. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Total strangers are not out there inventing ways to save you money. They are out there inventing ways to make money for themselves. And that's fine as far as it goes. Just recognize it for what it is. As Jesus says in a very different context, be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves, Matthew 10:16. Remember, it's not just record club memberships and timeshares people are trying to sell you. There's never been a better time to buy sin, and Satan is a great salesman. But like Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 2:11, we are not ignorant of his schemes. See through the glittering generalities and celebrity endorsements. Don't buy Satan's lies. Do what Proverbs 23:23 says. Buy and do not sell truth, wisdom, instruction, and understanding. This is what I've been playing. In episode 122, the blending episode, I brought to your attention a game that missed the mark with us, Between Two Castles of Mad King Ludwig. If you're unacquainted with modern board games, you likely think that's the weirdest title for anything you've ever heard of. Personally, I'm very well acquainted with modern board games, and I think the title is pretty weird too, for what that's worth. But that's not why we didn't care for the game. Go back and check that episode out if you want my rationale. I don't care to go over it again here. I bring it up because we are becoming more and more committed in Casa Hammonds to keeping games we know we will play and enjoy, and finding ways to get rid of games we know we won't. If you looked at our board game closet right this very moment, you likely would have doubts as to the success of this venture, and to a certain extent, you'd be right. I have no intention of taking perfectly good games, though perhaps not to my personal taste, and throwing them in the garbage. I'm the guy who tears pieces of paper off used envelopes to write out shopping lists. My mom lived through the Great Depression. On the rare occasion she buys meat, she reuses the styrofoam trays that the meat comes on. Letting things go to waste is not in my DNA. Anyway, we've tried various approaches. We've straight up donated some of them and then seen them go to waste. Not good. We've sold some of them to the local used bookstore and gotten a pittance for them. That's maybe a little better. Ideally, I'd like to put my gently used game directly into the hands of someone who wants it. And we're working on ways to facilitate that process. But the most satisfying approach so far has been to get involved with trades. One particular website is good at helping gamers from all over the world compare wish lists and for trade lists. You submit a trade suggestion for a total stranger in wherever, and they accept, reject, or counter it. The appeal of this approach is obvious. Someone gets the specific game they want, and I get a specific game I want. Granted, that doesn't help with the downsizing much, but I do get a game I want, and all I have to pay is postage. And therein lies the rub. Postage, like pretty much everything else these days, has gone through the roof recently. Our experience with Between Two Castles was particularly jarring. The person requesting the game was on some back road in a tiny town halfway across the country. It wound up costing as much in postage to send him my used copy of the game as it would have for him to buy it retail. In hindsight, it would have made more sense for me to throw in the garbage after all. Everything has hidden costs. Sometimes they're more hidden than other times, and sometimes they're more costly than other times. But it's rarely a simple matter of paying this to get that. Like we said in the previous segment, be wise as serpents. Know how deep the pool is before you jump in, especially if you're diving head first. Jesus says that about the gospel. In Luke 14, verses 25 through 33, he compares reactionary disciples to a tower builder who doesn't know how much the project will cost, or a king who goes to war without knowing how big his enemy's army is. He says a believer must bear his own cross. Jesus knew how heavy his cross would be, and he chose to bear it anyway. He did not buy a pig in a poke, and he doesn't want us to either. In fact, he turned away would-be disciples in Luke 9, 57 through 62. If you're not willing to go where he's gone, you can't be his follower. And how can you agree to go where he's gone if you don't know where that is? And it's all fine and good to sound committed like Peter did in Luke 22, verses 33 and 34, saying he'd follow him to prison and to death. When it comes down to brass tacks, our commitment often falls as short as Peter's did that night. That doesn't mean you shouldn't commit to Jesus, or that you should wait until your understanding and commitment are absolutely complete. It means you decide in principle whether Jesus is worth everything you have. And if the answer is yes, you go forward and you pray for strength, patience, and mercy. You're going to need every bit of all of the above that he has to offer. Thank you for listening to the Citizen of Heaven podcast. Please rate, review, and share so others can access this content. I encourage you also to join the Heaven Citizens Facebook group. There you will find links to related materials, conversation starters, poll questions, and the occasional special announcement. Also, check out the Hal Hammonds channel on YouTube for even more content. Until next time, be strong and courageous, fight the good fight of faith, and do all things in the name of the Lord Jesus. This is Hal Hammonds, Citizen of Heaven, signing off.